supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight.
I believe that the new map that the Supreme Court justices have put in place is a great benefit to all of the citizens of Pennsylvania.
That's Tom Renschler, one of the original plaintiffs in the case challenging Pennsylvania's congressional map. Having ruled that map unconstitutional, the state Supreme Court issued a new one yesterday, and some experts say it could shift up to 6 congressional seats from Republicans to Democrats. For more on the implications of the new map, let's turn to Chris Borick, professor of political science and director of the Muhlenberg College Institute of Public Opinion. Chris, politics aside, what does the new map mean for those running for Congress in Pennsylvania?
Well, you know, there's a whole bunch of moving parts right now for this day. First of all, incumbents, where they're still in the suburban Philadelphia districts, have to think about what their new district looks like. They are dramatically shaped. I mean, from the numbers themselves on the district to their makeup, it's a whole different political landscape. And so the incumbents have to really think, first of all, does the current district offer anything for them in terms of opportunities to get reelected? And second, what does the competition look like coming forward? So I think there's going to be a lot of soul searching. There's a lot of indecision right now on the part of members that are thinking about running for Congress this year, simply because they don't know if these lines are going to hold, first of all, and if they do, what it's going to mean for their chances.
I guess in that context, it's little surprise that President Donald Trump today encouraged Pennsylvania Republicans to fight in court all the way to the Supreme Court if necessary.
Yeah, I think the president recognizes that Pennsylvania could be a really pivotal state in determining who's going to control the House of Representatives after this year. You have to put it into political cycles, too. You know, in the standard midterm election after a president comes into office, his party struggles. That would mean good news for the Democrats, a little bit of wave at their back. The large number of open seats this year, even if we were to keep the existing district lines that are in Pennsylvania, provided opportunities for Democrats. And now that if you layer in these new districts into that already, I think, potent mixture, there's a chance for significant pickups for Democrats throughout the Pennsylvania. And I think Southeast Pennsylvania is probably the epicenter, and if you include the Lehigh Valley in that area.
The 7th congressional district boundary shape was known far and wide across the country. Are there other states with similarly gerrymandered districts in place that might also wonder if they'll be next?
Oh, I think so, Dave. I mean, the 7th, while very famous in our world and indeed nationally, is one of many like that. There's examples of that in states like North Carolina that seem equally bizarre and tortured in their nature. And other states are looking at Pennsylvania, right? This is, I think, for individuals looking, there's a path to the U.S. Supreme Court to look at this from a United States Constitution in terms of the way they are drawing those lines, and the court's entertaining those cases right now. But Pennsylvania might be a path for other states to look through their own state constitutions as ways to, you know, come up with a path to redesigning these districts to make them less gerrymandered in the end.
The court, in providing this new map, says it wasn't considering partisanship. Instead, factors including contiguousness and population density. Does that pass muster in your mind, or is everything partisan now, including court decisions?
Yeah, you know, Dave, I think it's hard to argue against the fact that the state Supreme Court looked at the competitiveness of these districts. Sure, they've been made more compact. Sure, there are more representative of existing county lines. Those are things that they've done. But a number of the maps that were put forth by the Republicans in the state legislature did the same thing. What I think the court valued, and if you look at the decision that was made and the opinion that was offered by the court, they did suggest the idea of what is fair and equal does have an element of competitiveness in it. And I think they've tried to do that. Now, is that in line with what they should be doing? I think that's a fair argument. It absolutely opens the door for Republican critiques of the state Supreme Court plan. They can say, hey, there's obvious Democratic bias in how some of these districts have been designed. Would the U.S. Supreme Court say that the state Supreme Court reading of their own constitution and somehow doing that is a violation of federal law? That's a whole separate question.
Chris, thanks so much for helping us paint the picture.
It's my pleasure, Dave.
Dr. Christopher Bork, professor of political science and director of the Muhlenberg College Institute of Public Opinion. Only around one-third of Americans approved of the Republican tax overhaul when it passed in December. That number has been rising. And this afternoon, Pennsylvania Senator Pat Toomey visited a manufacturer in Delaware County that has made some changes as a result of the new law. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports that Toomey's visit was part victory lap, part pep rally.
New Hudson Facades in Linwood, Pennsylvania, makes the glass and aluminum skins that cover skyscrapers. Speaking to workers on the factory floor, Toomey credits the tax bill that he helped author with making the company stronger.
The tax bill that we recently passed was designed to encourage continuing growth for companies like this.
The senator's visit is part of a string of such appearances by Republicans to highlight businesses who say they're using the money they're saving on their tax bill to raise wages. Managing partner of New Hudson Facades, Alan Cohen, says that's exactly what his company did.
We raised wages, yes. We tried to keep it around 5%, but in addition to that, related companies has given every factory employee $3,000 in their 401k.
Related Companies is a partner in the facility. These press events amount to a charm offensive to try to sell a law that's already passed so it has a chance of surviving long term. It appears to be working. Polls show the tax bill had an average approval rating of 33% when it passed in December. Recent polls by Monmouth University and the New York Times put that approval rating closer to 50%. Whether these one-time wage increases and bonuses will continue isn't clear. At New Hudson Facades, the only tax question Toomey and Cohen took from the audience was, will cost of living raises go up too? The answer was, we'll have to wait until we see our tax bill. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
Philadelphia officials say they'll work to open a controversial safe injection site where drug users can shoot up under medical supervision. And many expect that first site will be in Kensington, the heart of the city's opioid crisis. This troubles some members of local neighborhood groups. They feel the city isn't doing enough to address other problems tied to drug use. For WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Joel Wolfram reports.
The monthly meeting of Somerset Neighbors for Better Living begins with the usual update on crime stats from Police Captain Daniel O'Connor.
All right, hello everyone. It's always a pleasure being here.
The few dozen people seated in the sanctuary of the Rock Ministries Church listen quietly as O'Connor rattles off figures on theft and armed robberies. Then O'Connor arrives at a topic that strikes a nerve.
As far as the issues with the homeless and the addicts down in the tunnels and things like that.
Residents chime in with pointed questions. They want to know what police are doing to address the chaos around encampments of homeless drug users along Lehigh Avenue. O'Connor replies that officers are patrolling the area and will intervene when trouble starts, but they can't arrest people just for being homeless. That answer doesn't satisfy everyone.
They're having sex in front of the kids. They're shooting up in front of the kids. I'm over it. So, like, my kid's getting on a bus and a dude was, like, playing with himself right there. What am I supposed to do about that?
Exchanges like this have lately become a ritual at meetings of Somerset Neighbors for Better Living, says member Amanda Fury.
They want to come here, ask the police captain, ask whoever they can, and get some motion or some answers.
Residents have a long list of grievances that includes used syringes and human feces littering streets, sidewalks blocked by makeshift tents, and always having to be on guard for overdosing users. These are problems they say wouldn't be tolerated in other neighborhoods. The Somerset group has been meeting with city officials since last fall to plead for more help. But Fury and other members of local civic groups say they're not getting real solutions yet. That makes them highly skeptical of a safe injection site, where drug users can shoot up under the supervision of trained medical staff. The first site will most likely end up somewhere in Kensington. Fury says many neighbors have positions on this that aren't as simple as being for or against.
It keeps getting dismissed as, oh, just not in my backyard attitude.
She worries about a safe injection site making the drug-related problems they're already dealing with worse.
I feel like a lot of the neighbors don't have a lot of confidence that the city's going to take those needs seriously and do things to address them. And that's really important, too, is taking care of the neighborhood.
The city says it's addressing conditions in the neighborhood, removing trash, and deploying additional police officers specially trained in dealing with homeless people. And a report commissioned by the city suggests neighbors don't have reason to worry about the effects of a safe injection site. Experts found that the sites can actually reduce public drug use and the amount of discarded syringes nearby, while having no negative effect on drug dealing and overall crime. But they cautioned that much of this evidence comes from just one site in Vancouver that was the first to open in North America. These potential benefits are not changing many minds yet, and residents have long had doubts about the city's intentions for the neighborhood.
This has been a forgotten area for a long time.
That's Elmira Smith, another member of Somerset Neighbors for Better Living. Smith says the neighborhood's problems have been fueled by decades of neglect. Still, she says she would support a safe injection site opening in Kensington in the right location.
Every person is important, whether they're addicted or not. And this is something that would lead to them getting clean and living a better life.
Smith thinks a safe injection site could gradually turn the neighborhood around if it gets more people on the road to recovery. The city is calling them comprehensive user engagement sites and says they would provide additional services that would encourage users to enter treatment. But others are more skeptical. Shannon Farrell is the president of Harrogate Civic Association, the Somerset group's neighbor to the north. She compares a safe injection site to resources like needle exchanges that were introduced in the past. She says they help drug users, but came at a cost to local residents.
Needle exchange helps them. Great. We're glad that it did. But now our kids run around in a neighborhood full of needles. So they have to come up with a plan that includes us. And what they have said so far doesn't.
Farrell opposes opening a safe space to inject drugs until the city can convince her that it's got the local neighborhood's back. But she admits that a safe injection site could save lives. The city estimates a single site could prevent up to 76 fatal overdoses per year. For its part, the city says it will continue to meet with neighborhood groups and involve them in its decision-making before choosing a location. That could be an opportunity to allay the concerns of many residents who want to help drug users, but keep asking, what about us? For WHYY, Joel Wolfram.
While Kensington has been in the spotlight lately as the visible center of Philadelphia's opioid crisis, other parts of the neighborhood are being transformed by gentrification. One of the long-standing anchors of Kensington is its Veterans Club, the AmVets Post 146 on Sargent Street. A new book, The Good of the Order, chronicles the history of the neighborhood from the perspective of the AmVets Club. It's based on 50 years' worth of notebooks kept by the club's founder, recently discovered in the basement. WHYY's Peter Crimmins visited the club and spoke with its steward, Edward Hepworth, and author Gerald Shields.
You know, growing up here, this was really the kind of neighborhood beacon. This is where everybody hung out. I played baseball here. And then as we got older and we were able to drink, it was even more so. You'd come in because, you know, most of the bars, you know, beers were $4. You come in here and you get, you know, 50 cents, 75 cents. And more so, you know, you needed a job. You came here and asked somebody if they had a job. If somebody was sick, they would raise money for the sick children. If your house burnt down, they'd have a fundraiser for you. So it was always a place where it was a lifeboat. It was a lifeboat for the neighborhood.
We used to, at Christmas time, you maybe only got your Christmas present here. We had a skylight in the roof here. And the guy two doors away would be Santa Claus and walk across the roof, come down. We'd all be sitting on the floor, and that might be the only Christmas present you got that year.
And judging by what I'm reading in the book, the parties were thrown here, sort of epic parties.
Oh, yeah, oh, yeah. Well, originally, they were allowed open to 4 o'clock in the morning. So you came here, you went to the AD club, it closed at 2 o'clock, and then you could be back here from 2 to 4. And most of the time, people were supposed to be going to church. They stopped here and missed church. in the morning on Sunday mornings.
Someone would be sent to church to get the bulletins so that you could go home and say to your wife, hey, I was at church. And he would make them listen to the homily, too, so you could tell the wife what the homily was about. So he'd come back and give everybody instructions. I already talked about chapter 17.
It was a little rough, but yeah. It was, you know, everybody cared for one another, belonged to this place.
To put this book together, you relied heavily on Joe Manko.
Right.
Who was Joe Manko?
Joe was a founder. He was one of the founders. So he went to World War II, and he came back, and then Happy could tell you, he took over a lot of the
Veterans Affairs and everything. He would tell the guys, you know, where to go if they needed help and apply for different things. Ran the whole show. He actually kept the club alive. I never seen a man drink ever in my life. I knew him for 60 years. I never seen him drink.
And it was kind of
he was real quiet.
But he was here all the time. Yeah.
He would come in every Saturday, and, you know, we'd go, quiet, here comes Joe, you know, because we were rowdy when we were younger. And he basically, nobody actually knew he was writing this.
Yes.
And you found the notes that he took for years, for 50 years or more, probably?
Yes.
He died in, 2005, and so he kept it till 2000.
Yeah.
So it went from 47 to 2000.
How many notes were there? I mean, how
there's
much?
360 pages.
So one of the things he did that was cool, he kept all the minutes, he had all the photos of the veterans, he had these hilarious stories from the newsletters, and but one of the things he did, he weaved in American history. You know, these guys were telling an American story. They watched America evolve from this club, and they participated in it. You know, they go over to World War II, they defeat the most evil man, arguably, in world history. They come back, they humbly tuck their medals in the closet and begin building this economic force. They're part of it. And the thing that was cool is that they commemorated issues. So we had Beans Gannon, who was like the costume guy. So the first man lands on the moon. Beans goes around the corner, gets a motorcycle helmet, some vacuum cleaner parts, comes walking in an astronaut. So Neil lands on the moon, and so does Beans.
The club, around, what, the 70s, 80s?
Oh, yeah, it turned big time. Well, you lost a lot of people moved down the neighborhood. The membership really went down big all over with VFWs, everybody.
Yeah, there was a meeting in 1980 where they were going to vote whether to close the club or not. Right after that, kids of the founders start coming in and making the cash registers rise again. We took over the jukebox, and every time these doors were going to close, something happened that kept them open. This place is as strong as it's ever been, financially, membership-wise. But the other thing that's really critical, the month before we had our anniversary, we blocked the street off, the house band came out, and we raised $5,000 for a kid who had fatal muscular dystrophy. So to me, that was very critical because it showed that the spirit is still alive. The charity, the generosity, the caring for each other is still very much alive here.
Talking to Gerard Shields and Eddie Hepworth at the AmVets Post 146 in Kensington, the new book is Good of the Order. Thanks so much for talking.
Thank
You're
you.
Welcome.
Thanks,
Thank
Peter.
You.
Thanks for coming there.
Like many superhero movies before it, Disney and Marvel Studios' Black Panther is smashing box office records and earning critics' acclaim. What makes it stand apart from previous offerings is its connection with black audiences, and for NewsWorks blogger Solomon Jones, the film could be a turning point in representation.
I've seen the record-breaking film Black Panther twice now, and the movie, with its visually stunning portrayal of Africa and its people, is filled to bursting with truth about the black experience. Its majestic portrayal of black power and its crafty push for black freedom is especially enthralling to black audiences who've longed to see themselves in such cinematic splendor. In satisfying that itch, Black Panther earned an estimated $235 million over the Friday to Monday President's Day weekend, according to Forbes. That's the kind of record-breaking performance that will create opportunities for other black films to be made. As a novelist, I'm excited by the possibilities. But as an audience member, I'm thrilled that Black Panther created an even bigger opportunity for black camaraderie. I watched excitedly as African Americans showed up to watch the film in African garb, their dark skin shining in all its brilliance. I engaged in the film in ways I'd never done before, dressing as one of Oakland's Black Panthers as my wife sat beside me in combat gear. We were there not only to enjoy a film, but also to fight the idea that European imagery is the ideal. We were there to revel in a narrative that centered on Black brilliance. We were there to enjoy the pictures as much as to understand the plot. That much was evident to me when I saw the film for the second time. "She bad," said a woman sitting next to me, smiling gleefully as the screen filled with the image of Okoye, a majestic female general. It was a sentiment the woman would repeat throughout the film. And that, in my view, is the power of Black Panther. It moves Black people beyond the fake divisions of dark and light skin, income and social status, education and street smarts. In Black Panther, all of us, no matter where we come from, can hear the music of African accents dancing in our ears. We can experience Black hip-hop booming through the air. We can engage in a celebration we've waited centuries to see. We waited through slavery and Jim Crow, through lynching and segregation, through poverty and police brutality. And now, after all that waiting, we see Black Panther, where we are the heroes and the conquerors, the fathers and the sons, the queens and the sisters, the warriors and the kings. We are powerful because ours is a truth that is only now beginning to be fully realized. But telling our truth begins with telling our stories. It begins with grooming our griots. It begins with standing up and saying, "You will no longer portray us as slaves, no longer mistreat our community, no longer decide what's good for our neighborhoods. We will decide that for ourselves." That's why Black Panther matters. Knowing who we can be is as important as knowing who we are. And thanks to Black Panther, we know we can be kings. I'm Solomon Jones.
Solomon Jones writes the Philadelphia Experiment blog on WHYY.org. He can also be heard weekdays from 10 to noon on Praise 107.9 FM. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.